Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
Live from the Nasdaq market site in the heart of New York City's Times Square, this is Fast Money. Here's what's on tap tonight. Surging prices from copper and cocoa near record levels to the jump in beef, crude, cotton, and even lumber again. How will these moves impact the Fed and markets' next moves? We'll debate that. Plus, how about a little would you rather on a Tuesday? Spicy. The traders set to weigh in on a few leaders and laggards in a host of sectors, banks, industrials, travel, autos, and more. And later, Viking Therapeutics surging. The new data behind the move, a spectacular day for one DJT. Should buyers fear a day two and beyond? And Germany going to pot. How its move to legalize cannabis will impact the sector. I'm Melissa Lee, coming to you live from Studio B at the Nasdaq. On the desk tonight, Tim Seymour, Karen Feinerman, Dan Nathan, and Guy Adami. We start off with a stealth price surge that may signal inflation may be sticking around for some time. Cocoa prices topping the $10,000 mark for the first time ever today. The sweet staple has risen nearly 130% just this year. And it's not the only commodity on the rise, from pork to OJ to cotton. Agricultural asset prices are surging across the board this year. In fact, the DBA, the Invesco Ag ETF, is up 18% since Jan 1, on pace for its biggest quarterly gain on record. So do these moves suggest relief on the inflation front may not be as immediate as we hope? Guy.
Rhetorical question. So the answer is yes. And, you know, we look at this. DBA made a 10-year high, I think, today. And the major components, coffee, cocoa, soybeans, corn, live cattle, sugar to a certain extent, that doesn't even take into consideration what we're seeing in copper, what we're seeing in the energy complex. And you throw in a couple others. So the answer to your question, no, I don't think inflation is tamed at all. And I thought you'd start to see a reacceleration last fall. Maybe it's a little later than I thought, but it's happening now.
You're a little bit worried that it's stickier.
I am a little bit worried. I mean, we've talked a lot of times, every so however often the Powell conversation comes up. Why does he need to do it when especially inflation seems to be persistent, not as bad as it was, but this is certainly more evidence of that. And so I keep thinking, all right, maybe the market's like effervescent. They always think, all right, even if he doesn't cut now, he will one day. So let's put a high multiple on it. I'm a little concerned about that there won't be three cuts. And it actually was a James Gorman today.
Yes.
Did he say maybe they don't cut at all this year?
I would not be surprised if they didn't move at all this year.
Right. Well, if we were at this point 6 months from now, I would say, yeah, that seems the case. So I'm not that excited about this idea that we're going to see a cut and the market's going to rally.
The consumer, though, is still relatively strong, despite the higher prices that they're paying at the grocery store, at the pump. It's for car insurance, for health insurance, you name it. They are still spending. They are employed for the most part.
Yeah, they're spending, and they're spending for now. And I think we've all acknowledged that the financial conditions out there are extremely loose. You can look at credit spreads, which I've quoted go all the way back to June of 2007, tight in terms of at least a high-yield OAS. And I think the Fed did a terrible job last week in terms of their messaging on inflation and what they would do and how they would actually maybe begin to cut before that happens. And, you know, and he would never go out and say that. He's still data dependent. Those words were uttered over and over again. But the reality is that look at higher inflation in the form of higher interest rates that are slowly feeding into just higher prices. I mean, the cost of living has gone higher. Look at gold, which I believe closed at an all-time high today. Gold, a lot of times people say actually struggles under an inflationary environment, but actually it's really the opposite. It seemingly does hold its value. I think what we're seeing in gold and Bitcoin is loud and clear says the message on inflation is far from over.
You know, as it relates to the consumer, I mean, we didn't even mention education, healthcare. Look at some of these things. I mean, they're just structural. When you think about wages, ages, you think about demographics, and, you know, I just go back to, like, you know, we talk a lot about the CPI, you know, we're at, what, 3.2% or something like that. The average CPI, I think, over the last 25 years has been about 2.5% or something like that. You know what Fed funds has been on average over the last 2.5 years or 25 years? It's basically been 2%. So at some point, maybe the Fed needs to kind of rejigger that CPI target. I know that we've spent some time debating that or whatever, but the structural changes to, like, our economy and then some of these other more advanced economies with the demographic shifts going on, I mean, we're not going to get education under control. We're not going to get healthcare under control. So all that stuff that gets stripped out of the consumer stuff, at some point, I think we're probably going to have to change the narrative about where these numbers are, because that's the stuff that we spend a lot of time talking about on this desk.
There is a dichotomy between, you know, where the consumer, where the individual person thinks the economy is, mm-hmm. particularly when it comes to election year polls, and the picture that the Fed paints of the economy, which, you know, when they had the press conference, it was basically an all clear for 2024. And so you have to wonder, like, at what point does that converge and how does it converge and what does that mean for spending, for corporate profits, et cetera?
Well, there's a couple sort of counters mm-hmm. to what we just, I'm not sure if that answers your question. Where do they want real rates to be, right? Mm-hmm. So we have the 10-year and we have inflation, and right now there is some room there, if that's what the Fed wants to allow the, right?
Right.
Then they could have real rates by cutting, they would have real rates be small. That's one. And then one other thing that sort of unexplainably GDP has been really good, is there a productivity element in there that could persist that would give the Fed some cover to do that? I don't know. I just pose it as a question because we haven't been able to figure out why is GDP so strong.
Right. Yeah, so productivity could be an aspect that's not reflected. What's also not reflected, though, yet are some of the headwinds that we will face in terms of inflationary pressures that we have not fully seen yet. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking about some of the things that we invest according to, like the notion of reshoring. We talk all the time about the reshoring place. Well, you know what? Reshoring is inflationary. And so if we're going to invest in a stock because of the reshoring trend, then you got to see it at some point in the economy.
No doubt. We had 3 decades of China exporting deflation, and that was good. That was good for everybody. We all know China's in a very different place, both structurally their economy. And if you look at the CRB index, so the Commodity Research Bureau index, you could look at the CRB rind, which is slightly even kind of second derivative inputs. But CRB is really, first of all, it's up over 11% this year. Just year to date. That tells you the kind of move that we've seen. But if you look at it relative to history, when was the last time we were really having this anxiety when markets were kind of going haywire and also commodity prices were going to the moon and people were investing? I remember when people started investing in the resources asset class for the first time. A lot of people didn't even know. Obviously, you know what it is by the name, but they didn't really know what that meant. It's back in 2007. If you look at the CRB, it's making a run at those 2007 levels that were a function of a lot of different things. It included speculative environment and where I think we are, and you know, certainly interest rates were in a different place, and yet that was the beginning, really, of when the Fed had to cut to zero.
We'll do something later, the have and have nots, but in terms of the consumer, they're spending, but they're combating inflation with debt, which I think is a bit of a problem, but people have no choice. And the reason why, it's interesting, I think we've learned the hard way that asset prices have nothing to do with the economy, because if it was just about asset prices, the president's approval rating would be through the roof, and it's probably at historic lows now through the prism of just the economy, which tells you something about how people are feeling out there.
We've got a news alert on Merck, the FDA approving the company's drug Winrevair for the treatment of adults with high blood pressure. Shares are, in fact, jumping in the after-hour session, so this is something that we will watch very carefully. For Big Pharma, this is good news. We've certainly seen a lot of Big Pharma struggle because of looming patent cliffs, et cetera, the need to replace blockbusters, former blockbusters, with new drugs.
Although Merck's not one of them. Merck is one, and that really, you know, no one can talk in the same breath as Novo and Lilly, but Merck's about as close as you can get. They've been outperforming. Again, it's a portfolio that's connecting. If they're connecting in an area that we know is at least, you know, half a step away from also the GLP land, but also what they've been doing in oncology, what they've been doing in some of the other key parts of what I would say the high-margin drug world. Merck's near all-time highs. It's now through all-time highs, and I think it probably goes higher.
It's interesting, real quick. I mean, we've talked about this, but Merck will do 34% more revenues than Eli Lilly and trades at half the market cap of Eli. And I understand that Eli Lilly is in a completely different world, but don't underestimate how valuable and I think unappreciated the stock is, despite the fact, as Tim just said, at 130 and change, this is an all-time high.
All right, let's get back to what rising prices say about inflation. CNBC senior economics reporter Steve Liesman joins us now. Steve, I know you notice all the commodities that we've talked about that we've listed here hitting new highs, et cetera. You know this. Is this on the Fed's radar? Because consumers see it, consumers feel it, and yet the Fed gave the all clear at the last meeting.
Yeah, pardon me. It is. Pardon me. I just had a drink there. Water, of course. let me calm you down and then make you a little bit more anxious. The first thing is this: commodities don't feed directly into consumer prices. So, pardon me. You can have a surge in commodity prices and it won't necessarily show up in the CPI. The problem is that we have still high service inflation, and goods inflation and commodity disinflation has offset some of that. What we're losing through these higher commodity prices is the offset to higher service prices. This is the reason why, coming out of the meeting, and the past several days, I've been very concerned that the market's gotten a little too bullish on the outlook for the Fed. The reason is because when I look at the outlook for the March CPI report to be reported in April, I don't think it's going to show very much improvement. We have a PC report coming on Friday, and it seems like it's going to be kind of, you know, pretty much constant or pretty much unchanged relative to where it was in the prior month. So I think there's reason for concern here and not a lot of reason for optimism when it comes to the next couple months. I think inflation does eventually come down, but I think we're partially seeing, by the way, better global growth.
Steve, it's Karen. Thanks for being on, especially with the throat issue. Good luck with that. But why do you think that Powell seemed to be so dovish?
I think people maybe read a little bit more into what they wanted to hear into Powell. I think Powell was kind of neutral, and especially the thing that I thought was most neutral was looking at the dots, right? The dots shifted a little bit to the right. We were one vote away from losing that three-cut average or median among the Fed officials. And look, whoever was saying, I think it was Guy saying earlier, the Fed is indeed data-dependent. Maybe it was Tim. The Fed is data-dependent. If these numbers don't improve, you ain't getting your cuts. And so I think what you want to think about is if we don't get an improvement in March, which will be reported in April, what does that say to you about a June cut? And if we don't get the June cut, what does that say to you about the ability or the willingness of the Fed to execute three cuts this year? And I think that is definitely going to be suspect over time. I just think you got to be very careful here. Not that the Fed won't necessarily cut three times. They may do it. The question is, how much risk that you're wrong are you building into your outlook? It felt to me like the market went all in on the three cuts. I think there's some risk of that there's only going to, there's some possibility, probability there's only two. And Gorman may be right that there's only one.
Steve, thank you. We appreciate it. Steve Liesman.
Pleasure.
Our next guest says now is the time to shift focus from valuation gains to earnings growth. Fidelity Director of Global Macro, Jurrien Timmer, joins us now. Jurrien, great to have you with us. Welcome.
Good afternoon.
You're pretty bullish when it comes to this rally that we've seen so far.
Well, it's been obviously a very unusual cycle. I mean, we can credit the pandemic for that, and we're still feeling, you know, the effects from that. So the market bottomed, you know, in retrospect, it's easy to say, but it wasn't so much in real time. But the market bottomed October 2022, and then this January, the S&P 500 cap-weighted index finally made a new all-time high, which, you know, any technician or market historian will say, okay, that those are the bookends for a bear market and the beginning of a bull market. And the S&P 500 equal weighted index started to make new all-time highs just, you know, a few weeks ago after 26 months of sitting in limbo, basically. And, you know, a chartist will look at that and say, you know, that's more likely than not a basing pattern. And, you know, valuations are very high, as we all know, 21 times forward earnings, 23 times trailing earnings. And typically at this stage or by this stage, the baton would have been passed from valuation gains to earnings gains. And the good news is that those earnings gains are happening and that the market is broadening. You know, 81% of the S&P 500 stocks are now above their 200-day moving average. And fourth quarter earnings season was really good. You know, the estimated growth rate going into earnings season was 1%, and at the end of earnings season, it was 8%. So we have some good momentum, but the market has a lot of growing to do to start coming into its valuation, and that I think remains the challenge here. It's poised for perfection, and as you just discussed, even little things that might happen later than sooner, in like rate cuts or earnings gains, leaves the market kind of not over its skis, but it needs everything to go right here.
You just mentioned the equal weight S&P 500. You know, it's up about 5% year to date versus the market cap weight, about 9.25% or so. So we still have this outperformance from the concentration of these large names. When I think about the large names on a day like today, or just look at the way an Apple trades, right? Look at the way a Tesla trades. These were two of the largest stocks in that top 10 or whatever, the S&P 500. And you're kind of losing them. They're kind of losing their growth story. I mean, clearly losing their growth story. So when you want to shift from valuation to earnings, now, if we start to see some of these companies that have been massive outperformers, let's say we get a downshift of growth in the back half of the year, that could set up a pretty nasty scenario for the S&P 500, which you just said is expensive about 21 times.
I mean, it has been a conundrum to kind of, war game, if you will. What happens when the Mag 7, or, I look at it as sort of the Nifty 50, because we've had episodes like that in the past. What happens when they lose their momentum? Can it be a bullish broadening where the rest of the market sort of picks up the slack? Or is the power of those Mag 7 so great, because they comprise almost a third of the overall index, that if they lose their way, the index has to go down? And so I am heartened by, the year is only, 3 months in, but I am heartened by the fact that, the market had to really walk back from an unrealistically large number of expected rate cuts at the beginning of the year. I mean, market was expecting 6-7. It's now down from there and probably still too high. But the market's been able to do that without falling apart. And even with the Mag 7, as you just mentioned, they're starting to fray, but it's not really hitting the market, at least not yet. And so I'm heartened by the resilience in the broader tape, and I think it highlights the fact that 493 stocks, not to exaggerate, but a large part of the market has been sort of in this market purgatory for over 2 years, just sitting there doing nothing, being in a long trading range, while the Fed was obviously raising the cost of capital and while earnings declined modestly. And now, presumably, as that vice gets lifted from the market with the Fed, maybe giving back a few rate cuts, a few rate hikes, that the rest of the market can start to breathe again.
Jurrien, thank you. Jurrien
Timmer.
You're welcome. So I want to pick up where Jurrien left off, and that is, in terms of the digestion going from 6 cuts anticipated at the beginning of 24 to now 3, when we go to from 3 to
0, 1, 0,
whatever. We've digested that very well in terms of the market action, but what happens from 3 to sub 3, do you think?
Well, counterintuitively, I actually think that'd be really bullish for the market, because it would suggest nothing happened, nothing broke, this economy or this market can withstand no further or no new rate cuts, and I think that would actually be probably supportive of equities. I think people are wishing for the wrong thing in the form of rate cuts, because if you go back historically, when they start to cut is when things start to get dicey.
What do you think?
Yeah, it seems so far the market has just said, well, they will cut.
Right.
And that could continue even if they don't cut for a couple.
Oh, it'll happen in 25.
Exactly. So we're good.
Well, we've had this conversation. We had it, I think, last week that the market's early cycle. I mean, it depends on what you're looking at. I think the RSP ETF, which tracks the equal weighted S&P or just that outright, like, really is basically making effectively lows or hitting those lows against the S&P. So it's not like it's been a big outperformance yet. You know, I look at my portfolio and it's taken a long time. He was right to point out that certain parts are going up after 2 years. I mean, I look at GM, I look at Citibank, you know, I look at Delta Airlines. I mean, these things are rallying. The problem with the EPS outlook is that between communications and IT, most of that EPS is all coming right there. And the NASDAQ, Carter said this, is basically flat to the S&P. You could go back to 21 and kind of look at that relative index, even though I've certainly like to point out that until that really starts to break down, I think we're okay.
All right. Meantime, a busy port in Baltimore remains closed after a shipping tanker struck a bridge and caused it to collapse overnight. Search and rescue operations continue for 6 missing people, and federal authorities are examining the impacts on international trade. Eamon Javers is live in Baltimore with the very latest. Eamon.
Melissa, the city of Baltimore and the state of Maryland are settling in for what is expected now to be a very long recovery effort here at the Port of Baltimore. We heard from Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg just a short time ago. He talked about the economic impact of this bridge and this port and a little bit of a sense of what's ahead. Take a listen.
This is no ordinary bridge. This is one of the cathedrals of American infrastructure. It has been part of the skyline of this region for longer than many of us have been alive. So the path to normalcy will not be easy. It will not be quick. It will not be inexpensive. But we will rebuild together.
And Melissa, to give you a sense of just how much they're settling in here, take a live look at the bridge site here. They've been bringing in these trailers all afternoon. This looks like they're settling in for some workspace and a really robust effort here on scene for some period of time to come. There's a heavy infrastructure being brought in now for the rescue workers and the folks on scene. As you see behind those trailers, those shipping containers, that is the ship itself, which is now wedged under where that bridge would be with the wreckage of the bridge on its bow, the shipping containers there toward the stern. And there you see the bridge itself jutting up into open air where the bridge obviously would have continued on across the river here. You can see there an aerial shot of the ship as it's just frozen in place, has been there all day. We have seen some smoke coming from the smokestack, which would indicate perhaps that the engines are on that ship. But as of right now, no movement throughout the day here and no indication of when things might get back to normal here at the Port of Baltimore. Melissa, back over to you.
Eamon, thank you. Eamon Javers. Coming up, a heavyweight hitter in the biotech space shares of Viking Therapeutics surging after some promising data on a different type of weight loss drug. How the alternative had investors licking their lips next. Plus, a day one pop for Donald Trump's new media stock, what the surge could mean for his net worth and how much control he'll hang on to going forward. The details when Fast Money returns.
This is Fast Money with Melissa Lee, right here on CNBC.
The spirit of performance defines Acura, and now it's electric. Introducing the all-electric ZDX, Acura's most powerful SUV yet. While what powers their cars may change, the energy that makes Acura never will. Crafted using the same formula that brought them electrified supercars and multiple IMSA championships, the ZDX has track-tested performance that packs an energy all its own. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system and up to 313-mile range on a single charge and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is everything they said electric could never be. It was built with the driver in mind, just like Acura has been doing since the beginning. We could talk all day, but the only way to experience this electric performance is to drive it yourself. Unlock the energy and order yours at Acura.com.
What does it mean to be rich? Is it having more stories to share or time to give? Is it being able to keep your loved ones close or travel somewhere far away? At Edward Jones, we believe the key to being rich is knowing what counts. Your dedicated financial advisor will take a comprehensive approach to your financial strategy to help support what truly matters to you. EdwardJones.com/findyourrich. Edward Jones, member SIPC.
Welcome back. Viking Therapeutics soared as much as 28% today after reporting encouraging phase one results of its new weight loss pill. Trial participants lost up to 5.3% of their weight after taking the oral tablet for 28 days. Based on these phase one results, Viking is planning to initiate phase two later on this year. And remember, Viking really sold off hard when Novo Nordisk at their investor day released their data for their oral pill. And now it's being viewed that perhaps this pill has a better profile than Novo's.
When did we do? I think we brought this up maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago, if I'm not mistaken, after the first huge run up. We talked about, obviously, it's going to be a volatile name. However, you know, if you get a couple binary things right, this stock's going to be north of $85, $90. I think Oppenheimer put a $128 price target on it earlier today. So if you can withstand the volatility, which will be here in spades, I mean, this is one where I think you buy, put it away, and you hope you get a triple or quadruple out of this thing.
You have a little bit of Viking.
I have a little bit of that. And I guess my view is also this was part of that conversation we had 3 weeks ago. I think it was February 26th, 27th. Mm-hmm. And the analyst community, including the one we had on that night, pretty much said, I think you're going to get better data, more impressive data on the oral side. And boom, here it is. Stock didn't take out those levels. But speaking of takeouts, that's kind of the conversation we've been exploring. That can Viking really do this and come to market on their own? Having said that, I'm sure they believe they can. They did a raise at that point. And I remember Karen pointing out that this is a company that looks like they want to go at it themselves.
Well, they want to give the appearance, at least. I ultimately think they can't. But I don't know who. I mean, you could see an antitrust review, maybe, if either Lilly or
Novo. But there's plenty of other.
We talked about Pfizer. Tim and my Pfizer.
Including the guys that gave away Biohaven.
But they bought Seagen.
Yeah.
Can they do another deal on top of Seagen?
I mean, they're not the only one. Plenty of people would love to get into this business. I think ultimately they need a heavy hitter if they're in that lucky spot.
To bring it to market, to manufacture it.
Yes. Here's a question. Yes. So a few weeks ago on CNBC, I saw this really great documentary called Big Shot. Okay, it was on this whole GLP sector. So if we have all these companies, and we've had a lot of great CEOs, we've had a lot of analysts, we've had a lot of talk about what this TAM is, it seems like it's stuck at $150 billion, right? Is that kind of correct? Like at some point in the next 5-7 years or something like that. So we have all these companies who are doing all these amazing things, but insurance right now is not paying for it. We keep doing reports, and you spent some time on this in the doc talking about this. So ultimately, are we going to create an investment bubble in something that I know is amazing? It's not too different than generative AI and JPOs that are powering this or whatever. Are we going to create an investment bubble that ultimately will not be able to realize the most, you know, like fabulous hopes that we have right now? That's the thing that I would kind of worry about this space. These two megatrends seem very similar to me at a similar time in the market cycle also.
Well, we've gone through the full cycle of who else is hit by it. We went through snack foods. We went through sodas. We went through medical devices. I mean, so there's no question that has gone on here. Ultimately, what we also don't know is where the pricing for this drug is going to come in, not just because of competition, right, but because of the government. I mean, these are ultimately, you know, all use cases where the government's been very involved in the past and will be very, I'm sure, aggressive on pricing.
There's a lot more Fast Money to come. Here's what's coming up next.
A triumphant debut on the public markets as Donald Trump's new media stock rockets higher in its first day of trading. How the big move could pad his pockets ahead. Plus, the haves and not haves. Should you stick with this year's big winners or bet on a few comeback kids? Our traders give their picks next. You're watching Fast Money live from the NASDAQ market site in Times Square. We're back right after this.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
Welcome back to Fast Money. Donald Trump's new media stock surging in its first day of trade. Shares of Trump Media and Technology Group, ticker DJT, surging as much as 59%, even triggering a brief trading halt during the session. Shares finishing well off their highs, ending the day up 16%. This comes as fellow social media stock Reddit has surged in its market debut. Shares are up almost 9% today, nearly double the offering price in 4 days. And speaking of some meme stock frenzy, GameStop dropping after reporting results, a company reporting revenue of $1.79 billion. That is down 18% from a year ago. DJT, that's an interesting one. It's become maybe the memeiest of the stocks at this point.
The grand meme of them all, I guess. It really is sort of amazing, right? What I think there is still obviously a huge short interest and a huge desire to short. I checked in to see just how much it is. They said 138%. I said, wait a minute. So if I were to borrow that for a year, I have no chance of making money. They're like, well, I guess you could look at it that way. And really, it's more of a people want to borrow in the short term and wait till the liquidity improves. And so I don't think that TMTG shareholders yet have the actual shares of their account. That might happen tonight, which would make them, some of them, free to trade tomorrow.
Oh.
I think there's currently a lockup for DJT himself. We don't know if he's going to ask the board to waive the lockup, or, I mean, that'll be very interesting and important to this stock that, at the moment, is untethered to any kind of metric by their, and they don't want to be tethered to any metric.
Right.
Metrics are not.
They will not report them. They may never report them ever in their history going forward. But, you know, he supposedly wants to maintain control. So that should be an interesting twist to the whole thing. Apparently, when you go on Truth Social, there are a lot of users there who are shareholders who say that they want to hurt the short sellers.
Okay.
They actually use the same term as used in AMC, which is MOAS.
Mother of all shorts.
I didn't know this.
Yes. Yeah, they want to try and replicate that.
Maybe they will. Maybe they'll be successful. I mean, its history is repeating itself. Karen, I think it was on Thursday, she outlined how it was divorced, basically, of their fundamentals, if there are fundamentals. But you know what? We've seen this before. That can last. Right. The trajectory upward can last for a long period of time. It can stay crazy more than you can stay solvent. And the fact that you have to borrow. Think about what you just said.
I know.
It's preposterous.
Regardless of what one's views are, it's just so dangerous to be short this stock with absolute unlimited upside.
Yeah, it just speaks to a little bit like scarcity right now. If we just think about these IPOs that just came, they're both Astera and Reddit. They both lose money and they both basically doubled and they've been gapping up higher every morning on no news, right? So people are coming for those. They're coming for, you know, all the altcoins in the crypto, and then they're coming for SPACs again. So think about that. That's very reminiscent of second half 2021.
Coming up, call it a comeback. Some big names are far underperforming their rallying peers. Should you bet on their rebound or stick with the winners? We'll find out what the traders are doing next. And speaking of potential comebacks, a delivery downer for UPS on its investor day. Can this name turn itself into the total package? We'll debate that right after this.
Missed a moment of Fast? Catch us anytime on the go. Follow the Fast Money Podcast. We're back right after this.
Welcome back to Fast Money. Stocks closing near their lows of the day, with the S&P now down 3 days in a row, the Dow falling about 30 points, and the Nasdaq losing 0.4%. All three had been up for most of the session. Shares of Tesla charging higher despite a price target cut from Bernstein. Analysts calling for 30% decline in the stock. It comes as CEO Elon Musk calls for Tesla employees to install and show customers how to use the company's self-driving assistant system. And Apple announcing its annual developers conference kicking off June 10th. The company expected to announce its long-awaited AI strategy. In February, CEO Tim Cook said Apple was investing significantly in AI and teased an announcement later this year. And a couple of S&P index changes announced just this hour. MedTech company Roivant Sciences will be added to the S&P 400 mid-cap index. Roivant was founded by former GOP presidential candidate Vivek Ramaswamy. It replaces Sunrun, which will move to the S&P 600 small caps. Well, it has been a story of haves and have-nots across many sectors this year, some stocks seeing major gains while their peers have sat out the rally. So we thought we'd ask the traders to play a game of Would You Rather with some of 2024's notable leaders and laggards. And so we start off with the travel trade. Airbnb up 23% this year, while Expedia has lost 10%. So, Dan, do you stick with the winner or bet on a comeback?
Well, I think you bet on a comeback with Expedia, and I think it's a pretty simple trade here. Not anything against Airbnb, but this is a company expected to gross sales high single digits and earnings 20-plus percent for the next 2 years, trading about 11 times this year, 9, 10 times next. And so 88% gross margin, this and whatever. I mean, I think there's a lot of room for error here. And the other one, Airbnb, is just kind of narrow. Expedia has that VRBO business, too. So, to me, I think that you kind of get the best of both both worlds. The thing has acted well. They've already lowered expectations a little bit for the year, but Expedia looks interesting.
So they've underperformed Airbnb to Expedia 30% over really year to date, I mean, let alone 3 months. But Expedia's outperformed by almost 53-40 on a one-year basis. I just think it gets back to multiple. I think Airbnb is taking share, but at 30 times 24 EBITDA, I think it's expensive to the group by far, not by a little bit, by a lot.
All right, next, home improvement players heading in opposite directions. Masco surging nearly 15% since January, while Whirlpool has dropped over 7%. Guy?
Well, they just report, Whirlpool just reported earnings, I think, on the 29th of January. They gave ridiculous guidance, $13 to $15 for the full year, far below the expectations, I think, of $15.40. Okay, that's the bad news. The good news is the stock is more than 50% from its all-time high. And even if you take the low end of the guidance, say $13 for the year, it's trading at high single digits multiple, and we've traded down to levels that it's previously held. So Masco is a great company, but Masco's been lower left to upper right. Whirlpool's the catch-up trade here, I think.
Karen.
Yeah, I agree with Guy there. I think, you know, Masco, it's much smaller ticket items, faucets and sinks and things like that. All, of course, both related to home building space. But I agree, Masco has not missed. They've actually beat last few quarters. Whirlpool, as Guy laid out, has not, which I actually is surprising given what a under-promise, over-deliver management team this likes to be. At this valuation, also, they do pay, they have a good balance sheet. They do pay north of 6% dividend. Whirlpool.
All right, let's get to banks. Bank of America gaining over 10% this year, but still far underperforming Citigroup's near 20% gain. Karen, would you rather?
Well, I guess Bank of America, but I'm reluctant. I mean, just given the run, Citigroup has had quite a run. If you really, this were would you rather, I'd pick JP Morgan. I know.
Wait a second.
Would you rather?
It's a rather.
That's
rather.
Completely outside the realm of this particular game. I will not allow that.
He's too late. I mean, the jury's
happened.
Already heard it.
It just
Jamie Dimon, I mean, he's
right.
Watching in his office.
Toothpaste out of the tube. The eggs are
Whoa.
Scrambled.
Toothpaste out of the tube?
Tim.
Horse out of the barn? What?
BAC or City?
City. City on valuation here. I own City. I also own BAC, and I've watched them both have a very strong run. But the City run is, I think, based on more fundamentals than BAC's getting pulled up with the money center banks, the valuations, the capital give back, the more benign environment for credit, the more benign regulatory environment. I believe in that year of efficiency at Citibank.
Let's move on to autos. General Motors firing on all cylinders, gaining 22% compared to a 2% gain for Ford on the year. So, Guy, would you rather?
I would, you know, you would think I'd say Ford just because they seemingly trade together and GM's outperform, but it seems as though GM has figured it out while Ford is still struggling. And GM is within a whisper of breaking out of this sort of range we've been in. You know, you get through this 45 level, and we haven't seen it since probably 3 or 4 years ago. So GM in this game, Melms.
All right, coming up, the ups and downs for UPS shares dropping as the company laid out long-term growth plans, how they are planning to deliver, and what CEO Carol Tomei had to say about growing volume. Don't go anywhere. Fast Money's back in two. Welcome back to Fast Money. UPS delivering a big loss today. The stock down more than 8%, its worst day since it reported earnings in January. The slide coming after the company laid out its three-year forecast this morning. CEO Carol Tomei spoke to CNBC's own Morgan Brennan. Here's what she had to say about the current demand environment.
We did see volume leave us during the contract negotiation, and more than we expected, candidly. But I'm happy to report that we have brought 60% of that volume that diverted back into our network. And it's not just about winning back, it's also about winning new. We do believe that volume will be down in the first half of this year, but we expect it to return to growth in the back half of the year.
Analysts on the street, though, were skeptical of the forecast, some of them even calling it aspirational. Never a good description of a forecast a company gives. Tim, what did you make of this?
And this could have been part of that pairs trade segment we just did, but I that's exactly it. The questions are, can they get those numbers, including $108 to $114 billion in revenue by 2026, when, in fact, they're saying they're going to grow top line 2.5% in 24? And it also at least suggests that there's going to be acquisitions in there, which the market doesn't always want to hear about. So I think UPS is due for a comeback, even without Guy Adami lacing up the brown.
Yeah. They spoke specifically about health care. They talked up the growth in health care and the couple of acquisitions in terms of transporting cold things from the clinical, mm-hmm. you know, from the labs to different places, mm-hmm. and mentioned an acquisition potentially in health care specifically. As
right. I think that was part of the revenue, you know, $6 billion maybe of that 114, which might have been the midpoint there. There was nothing wrong with those numbers, except for people are quite skeptical of them. And very unfortunately, they came out with the bad start to this year. So already that's not good. And then they've missed their last one. So this was a company.
The last three or four.
Yes. Yeah. So that's not good. And so this is instead of, you know, under promise, over deliver, under promise and then lower deliver, which is.
Deliver, no pun intended. No pun intended.
Exactly.
Nice job.
And for Carol Tomei, who I think is a great CEO, it's been a very, very rough patch and disappointing for
sure. There's been some outreach to me recently.
Did he get you back on the force?
Yeah, it's not going to happen. But listen, I mean, at least they tried. But it just makes the FedEx numbers that we heard that much better if you put it into context. I don't think it's surprising that FedEx was up today in a pretty significant way on top of the move we saw a couple weeks ago.
Coming up, the grass is getting greener in Germany, how the country's new cannabis legalization will impact pot stocks. The executive chairman of a top cannabis company will join us next to lay it out. More Fast Money in two. Welcome back to Fast Money. Germany is the latest country to legalize pot for recreational use. In just a few days, adults will be able to carry up to 25 grams of weed in public, 50 grams for private use. Individuals can also grow up to 3 plants for consumption. The law will decriminalize and reclassify the drug as a non-narcotic. Curaleaf stock popping on this news last week. Let's bring in Executive Chairman Boris Jordan to discuss this opportunity. Boris, always good to see you.
Thank you, Melissa. Good to be here.
Some estimates are that the German market could surpass $500 million by 2027. Can you put it into perspective for us in terms of comparing that to the size of various markets here in the U.S.?
Yeah, I think the closest thing to compare it to is the Florida market, medical market, because it's a very similar piece of legislation. If you look at Florida, Florida has about 4% penetration of their population of about 25 million people. That's about a $2.5 billion market today. So the number is actually much, much higher. It's closer eventually to a $10 billion market in Germany because of their 83 million people versus Florida's 25 million. Now, we don't expect that to happen overnight. These things take a while to ramp, but we do expect that the market should triple probably in the next 12 to 18 months, and then we'll continue to see growth after that.
Hey, Boris, it's Tim. You've made significant investment in Europe, and in fact, I think really much unlike your peers, I should say, in the U.S. A headline like we've had today and in Germany in the past would have moved your stock 15%, 20%, moved the whole industry. How do you explain the somewhat muted reaction to this? Because we're getting incremental news flow in the cannabis space, and I run a cannabis ETF, and your company is a core position. It seems as if the market is somewhat, you know, thoughts?
I think there's a misunderstanding, first of all, amongst, let's be honest, that the bulk of the investors in the U.S. MSOs today still are retail investors, right? Large-scale institutions have not yet invested. We've only recently, since we've uplisted the TSX and now mainstream custodians are custodying our stock, we've only recently started marketing to large long-onlys, you know, the BlackRocks, the Fidelities, the Capitals of the world. They're doing their homework. They haven't invested in the market at this point in time, at least in the U.S. stocks. So I think we're really driven by retail. Retail, through Robinhood, for instance, doesn't have access to foreign stocks. So you have to be a retail investor as an account at Schwab or Fidelity or one of these other brokers to actually invest in this particular space. And I think that's one of the reasons. There's a lack of education. And a lot of U.S. investors, particularly retail, don't really know the European market, right? We invested 3 years ago. We've probably put in almost $400 million between the acquisition. We have the largest footprint. We today have the largest vertical business in Europe. We're selling in Germany, the U.K., and in Poland. We have a 23% share in Germany. So you can just imagine, obviously, we don't anticipate holding that kind of share forever, but with a market that's going to be a multi-billion dollar market over the next, you know, 2 to 3 years, we really hope to maintain a very large share. And we think we're going to be the biggest beneficiary, at least from the North American companies in Germany.
Do other countries follow Germany?
Oh, I think the way Germany goes, Europe goes. At least that's what I saw in other businesses. I used to be in the data center businesses and others in Europe, and I saw the same type of thing. Germany typically leads in regulatory reform, and you see other countries starting to follow suit. So we're already seeing the Czech Republic and Poland follow suit on Germany, very similar piece of legislation. Interestingly enough, Ukraine also making a similar decision to those other two countries. And we think that France, who's got a pilot program ongoing, is probably next in line to move in that direction. You know, the UK has a very strong medical program already. So, yes, we do think other countries will head in that direction.
Just curious, Boris, are the margins better in Europe than in the U.S. or other places?
It's difficult to tell at this point in time. Mm-hmm. At the moment, they're smaller only because the industry is still smaller and there's not enough scale. Mm-hmm. But we've now built the infrastructure for the scale. So as the business starts to grow, we do anticipate that general margins in cannabis are going to be around a 50% gross margin, around a 25% EBITDA margin.
Mm-hmm. Boris, thanks. Nice to see you.
See you too. Thank you.
Up next, Final Trades. Time for the Final Trade. Around the horn we go. Tim.
I think there's decent fundamental momentum in the auto space, but Ford, I'm also long GM, Ford Motor Company.
Karen.
Yes, I think, you know, this bubbly situation we're in, a lot of IPOs, a lot of banking to do, a lot of investment banking to do. I like Morgan Stanley, MS.
Dan.
Yeah, Expedia. Maybe get a little gap fill back towards 150.
Guy.
A few blocks south of here and west.
Yes.
World's most famous arena.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And a chance to clinch a playoff berth, as I said to Mel, and she's like, really?
Just the beginning.
She said, we have bigger fish to fry. I mean, she is so spot on.
I try.
Pinterest gets caught up in this wave as well, Melms.
All right. Thanks for watching Fast. See you back here tomorrow at 5 for more Fast. Mad Money with Jim Cramer starts right now.
All opinions expressed by the Fast Money participants are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of CNBC, NBC Universal, their parent company or affiliates, and may have been previously disseminated by them on television, radio, internet, or another medium. You should not treat any opinion expressed on this podcast as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of an opinion. Such opinions are based upon information the Fast Money participants consider reliable, but neither CNBC nor its affiliates and or subsidiaries warrant its completeness or accuracy, and it should not be relied upon as such. To view the full Fast Money disclaimer, please visit cnbc.com/fastmoneydisclaimer.
From pit lane to podium, the Las Vegas Grand Prix is providing fans a race day experience at the speed they deserve. With the help of T-Mobile for Business, our 5G advanced network solutions are powering race day operations with event-wide connectivity. From streamlined gate entry to an immersive app, giving fans blazing fast access to the sport they love. This is accelerating innovation. This is the Las Vegas Grand Prix with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.